Middletown podcast. I'm Kat Hughes, I'm a research officer at Middletown, and I'm also autistic. In this episode, we're talking about sleep. It's something that we all need, but some of us, myself included, find it very hard to get a good night's sleep. I chatted to two sleep experts, Debbie Spain, a cognitive behavioural therapist and consultant nurse who works with autistic people and people with ADHD, and Tassos Galanopoulos, a consultant psychiatrist at National Adult ADHD and ASD Services for South London and Maudsley NHS Foundation. They both have lots of experience in supporting autistic people to find sleep routines that work for them. So I was very keen to pick their brains. Thank you both, Tassos and Debbie, for joining me on the podcast. I'd love to start by finding out a little bit more about the relationship between autism and sleep.
We tend to refer to sleep and the autistic spectrum as, well, let's start with the autistic spectrum. We say we mention quite often it's a condition which is not good or bad or anything like that. It's just a different way of perceiving the world around us, a different way of processing information, sensory information as well, and responding to all of these stimuli in the environment, internal and external. And it's just like sleep. It starts from day one, and it's an integral part of who we are. And I guess one common thread between the autistic spectrum and sleep is exactly that. Sleep is something we all experience. We tend not to think about it until we have a problem with it. Otherwise, we just take it for granted. But I often say to, let's say, junior psychiatrists who are not very familiar with the autistic spectrum, if you ask an individual on the spectrum how they feel about the spectrum or how they perceive it, they will probably respond to you in a very similar way as someone else would respond about sleep. They will tell you, well, that's how I've always been. It's always been there. So I don't really understand what you want me to tell you about it. So, and I think that's quite fundamental to keep in mind. None of that, neither the autistic spectrum nor sleep are problematic or problems per se. They can create difficulties in our life, depending on, let's say, our circumstances, demands from the environment or from ourselves. And I guess that's probably a more holistic and a better approach comparing to the very clinical, old-fashioned approach, which we're not very... we don't like that very much. And I think we moved quite a lot from that point. But there are definitely from clinical experience, but also from research and studies that have been conducted so far, there are quite a lot of, let's say, indicators that somehow individuals on the autistic spectrum their sleep-awake patterns and the overall quality and quantity of sleep is significantly different comparing to the non-autistic individuals. And I guess we will talk a little bit more about that later.
It makes sense because I almost sort of naturally think of sleep as sort of like a yes-no binary approach, but it's so personal and so individual, and how it might change or impact you is so personal. And I'd never really thought of it in that way before, so that's really interesting. What are some common sleep challenges or difficulties that autistic people might experience?
So I mainly meet adults in my kind of clinical work, but I'd say some of the really common things that people describe are difficulties getting off to sleep, so going to bed and then finding that as the room is quiet and hopefully outside is quiet, their mind is quite busy, either thinking about things that might have happened in the day that perhaps were a bit more stressful or a bit more anxiety provoking, or maybe worries about things that might happen the next day or that are coming up. And there's almost a loop of thinking of it, kind of starts kind of, you know, the what if questions or the worst case scenario scenarios that come to mind. And I think that can make it really difficult for people to get off to sleep because their mind is so busy. And it's almost hard to be distracted from that. I meet quite a lot of women. I'd say men as well, actually, but people who have kind of difficulty sleeping. So, you know, they might fall asleep, but might wake up quite early, 3 or 4 in the morning. And their mind is quite busy at that point. So maybe they've noticed that they're worrying kind of when they wake up, and then find themselves in a dilemma, kind of, what do I do now? Do I stay awake? Do I go back to sleep? And some people, we all do it sometimes, but we end up kind of scrolling on phones or tablets, and then that's it really engaging. And so people end up having this long period in the middle of the night where they're not sleeping and not feeling refreshed in the morning. And then I guess a last thing that seems quite common is when I meet people who feel quite down in their mood, so depressed or low in mood, people have difficulties kind of getting up in the morning. So they might be awake but not feeling massively kind of alert and refreshed, but might spend quite some time in bed, like a couple of hours, even longer maybe, where they're almost kind of thinking about the things that need to be done in the day. But when our mood is low, everything feels quite effortful, doesn't it? So sometimes people describe feeling a bit stuck, that they know that staying in bed's not massively helping them, it's not making them feel better, but that hurdle of like throwing the duvet off and climbing out of bed and starting the day feels really like too much mood wise and maybe anxiety wise. So again, that can sometimes put people off like going to bed. They feel like if they go to bed later, they might wake up later and they lose less of the day. So I think to summarize that, I think people have difficulties getting off to sleep, staying asleep and knowing what to do when inevitably people wake up, because we all do sometimes. But then that morning, like starting the day, can be quite tough.
And would you find that they're specific to autistic people, or maybe more common in autistic people, or just across the board, they're the issues that you see people struggling with?
I mean, I don't know what Tassos thinks. I would say this is on average, so not every autistic person who I've met, but I think people are less likely to mention sleep difficulties to someone else. So whereas if I haven't, like a lot of us probably haven't slept very well this week because it's been so hot, I might text someone and like moan about it. I think maybe an autistic person might be less inclined to share something about their sleep with someone else, because it's, as Tassa said earlier, it's a thing that we just do all, you know, every day, hopefully. It feels so kind of innate that we don't think to mention it. So I think people are kind of stuck with that, and that gives less of a way out. So if someone's kind of ruminating or reflecting when they go to sleep, they might have fewer strategies to draw from that might be useful, and they might mention it less to other people, so have fewer strategies suggested to them. They're my initial thoughts. Tassos, I don't know if you want to kind of add something there, not to put you on the spot.
Just to expand a little bit on what Debbie said, and I completely agree with that. So that kind of links very well with this idea of, you know, how do we approach sleep, and what do we think about sleep? Because you see, one of the sleep is we sometimes think that sleep is a very inactive kind of part of the 24-hour cycle, but actually, it's not for the brain. It's so active and therefore so crucial for our well-being and all of that. And sometimes, so the difficulties getting to sleep or the frequent awakenings or difficulties going back to sleep is probably something people can, because it's more tangible, so they can actually describe it and communicate it easier. The last part, which is actually linked to the architecture of sleep. And as we talk about the autistic spectrum being a spectrum, similarly, sleep is, you know, that it goes in cycles and in different stages and everything. And we may very well sleep for, let's say, 8 hours. But if what we call a restorative sleep is not enough, then we end up waking up the next day feeling quite groggy, I guess, not very refreshed, and generally not ready, as Debbie said, to start the day. And that kind of has a knock-on effect on things like how we perform the next day, how we communicate with our friends and our colleagues and our peers at school and everything, and how much we can take on, and how our executive functioning, meaning our attention and concentration and all of that. So these are kind of knock-on effects, and they actually originate from this lack of restorative sleep, which is, I guess, a little bit more difficult to describe simply because it's more abstract, less tangible. But I wanted to add, while listening to Debbie, I couldn't help but to think that just like the autistic spectrum, right? One of the reasons, and that's an assumption, but this is actually feedback from, you know, loads of service users. They say that one of the reasons they don't raise these kind of concerns, or they don't communicate these issues to family or their friends and partners and everything, is simply because sleep, let's say sleep-wake patterns or sleep difficulties linked to the autistic spectrum are in most cases lifelong conditions. So they, and when something happens regularly and over a long period of time, individuals tend to forget that, wait a second, maybe this is not how things should be. Maybe there is another way. And they take it as a given that this is how it is. And unless someone kind of, you know, provides them with a tool or encourages them to open up and talk about it, then it kind of remains a little bit, you know, it fades in the background a little bit. And I guess that's why we keep pointing out that it goes both sides. You can't only expect the other person to open up and tell you about, explain to you everything. You need to somehow be aware and create this environment to enable people to kind of articulate any kind of difficulties they may have.
Definitely. And yeah, that's so interesting, because I think being autistic is sort of like an endless list of sort of going, oh, everyone doesn't think like that, and constantly learning it. And for me, it was the same with sleep. I was like, the two sleep patterns that you mentioned, Debbie, of sort of the 3 a.m. scrolling and then also the sort of the mind sort of worrying over anxieties. Both of those things, I only relatively recently realized that everyone doesn't do that. So yeah, it makes perfect sense.
I thought of two other challenges, if that's right, going back to your question about perhaps specific or more specific for autistic people. The first is, I was thinking that some people live somewhere very quiet, very rural. There isn't really a lot of sound. There's not kind of new sounds. You know, you've got the kind of the wind or the rain, but you don't have lorries going past or buses or people walking home after a pub at 11:30. So I think some people do describe like sensory, or not necessarily a heightened sensory state at that time, but actually when we go to bed and we're quiet in our rooms, we're just much more likely to notice the sounds around us. So for people who, you know, are married and share a bedroom, or people who live in a house with other people, I've met lots of people who find that quite difficult because they've decided to go to bed to sleep. But actually someone's next door listening to music, another person's on the phone, the bathroom's like quite noisy, so someone's decided to have a shower, the washing machine's going in the background because someone in the house needs a shirt for the next day. So all of those, like the sensory kind of there's just a lot of sensory stuff going on, and the person doesn't have a lot of control over those things. It's not like they can make the house kind of quieter in that moment. And so I think that can be quite challenging, because then people, again, either try to distract themselves. Most of us will go on our phones, won't we? So we're scrolling on our phones, and then that's obviously alert, you know, making us feel more alert, even if it's not designed to do that. And then the last thing I think that could be more relevant for autistic people, but is a bit on a tangent, is sometimes people go to the doctor, they might have a diagnosis of anxiety or depression, they might be prescribed an antidepressant medicine, or maybe an anti-anxiety medicine, or a sleeping tablet. I mean, I'm not definitely not pushing any of these things, but what you might find is that maybe the health professional hasn't fully explained like all of the effects of the medicine, or the possible side effects. Like some tablets make people feel quite fatigued, like quite exhausted at the beginning. Actually, the same would be true of medicines for like blood pressure or high cholesterol. So there is some research that says that some autistic people might be more sensitive to the effects of medicines. Certainly clinically, people do describe that sometimes. But I think if the health professional hasn't fully described what it might be like, then people start to take medicines, feel really, really like physically knackered for some days, and that can quite understandably be worrying for the person who thought the medicine was going to help them feel better. And so I think that sensitivity to like starting a medicine or dose changes can then contribute to either feeling just asleep, really knackered all the time, and maybe having a sleep in the day, and that really impacts on sleep at night time. Or it might be just feeling really incredibly groggy in the morning and wanting more, you know, sleeping for 10 hours or 12 hours. And then that again also disrupts that sleep wake cycle that Tassos mentioned before. So I suppose I'm moving into more strategies, but I think that can be problematic. And if people don't have all the information about medicines and how it might be relevant for them, I think people don't always make the connection between I started a medicine for my blood pressure and actually I feel really kind of knackered since then, or feel really alerted. Some medicines make people feel actually almost quite alerted, and the doctor hasn't said always take it in the morning, for example. You know, don't take it in the afternoon because it might kind of keep you a bit awake. So that might be relevant for some people.
Absolutely. And then Tassos, you sort of already mentioned a bit about the sort of the impact that inadequate or disrupted sleep can have, but I'd love to hear sort of more about whether there's like short-term or long-term impact of that from either of you.
So when we talk about, you know, our daily functioning, and that's something very dynamic, right? You know, it really depends on, let's say, if someone who is in primary school or secondary school, or when we move on to you know, higher education and everything, demands are very different in life. And the same applies, you know, with jobs and everything. So I guess we always need to keep that in mind, that it's not a blanket approach, right? Yeah, it doesn't mean that the expectations, I mean, the cognitive, or if you like, academic expectations will be the same throughout, you know, someone's life. But it makes sense that when the demands are higher, any kind of difficulties we may have with sleep, and especially as we said with the restorative part of sleep, which then affects how we, you know, very, very basic functions of our brain, let's say our ability to remember information and recollect them very quickly in a conversation, our ability to filter incoming information or internal thoughts we may have, our ability to kind of filter sensory stimuli and keep them in the background, it's compromised, not necessarily because someone is autistic, but simply because the lack of restorative sleep, we know that. We know that from research, it is, you know, it's been proved actually, does affect how efficiently, let's say, our brain will kind of carry out these tasks. And they do sound very simple, but they're so complex because our brain constantly engages in this kind of process. It's not like, oh, right now I need to filter, you know, and prioritize where I need to focus at, and then I don't need to do it later. It's something we do all the time, and that's why we don't actively think about it. But it is there. So you can see that the moment something starts, you know, let's say going a little bit wrong, the impact will be, you know, very often people say, so, is it because I'm autistic that my sleep is not okay? And actually, the answer is no, not necessarily. So as Debbie said, the three main factors that people tend to kind of ignore or maybe not take into consideration is any side effects from medication, the sensory processing, and also the different kind of habitual patterns, which may or may not be linked to the autistic spectrum. So some people are naturally, let's say, morning types, some people are more evening types, and the problem can be, so for example, I am not very much of a morning type, but if you, because society is not very flexible with these things and they try to push you to adjust in a very specific kind of time frame and everything, the pressure to abide to this time frame, which is intrinsically, you know, different from your personal, let's say, time clock, body clock and time frame, will create long-term issues, regardless if you are on the spectrum or you're not. So, and I'm saying that because I don't want, because I've heard it so, you know, so often in the past, and I don't want people to necessarily think of the autistic spectrum as, you know, as a cause from the sleep problems. There are links, and there's quite a lot of research around that. But by no means that kind of translates that if you're autistic, you will the sleep problems you may or may not have are because of the diagnosis of the autistic spectrum. So I think that's quite significant to remember when we talk about. I don't know, Debbie, if you wanted to add more about the effects of the lack of restorative sleep, you know, late in the day and everything.
I mean, I could definitely do that. But I was just also thinking that sometimes there's an assumption that if someone has like a, they're always a morning person, they make an assumption other people around them, they will always be a morning person, or that if they have problems getting off to sleep now, it's with them for life. And I think the difficulties that people experience with their sleep, and we all do from time to time, they can change. So depending on the person, you know, where the person's living and what they're doing with their day and how they're kind of feeling in themselves, you know, they're having a good time or they're having a more difficult kind of period in life. So I think, like, if we put into Google like sleep problems, like lots of things come up, and it, but in a way it can feel quite flat. And I think people don't always give themselves the, like, credit's the wrong word, I can't think of a different word, but like the option, like the kindness, I suppose, the self-kindness that this might be difficult now, it might, hopefully it will get better in time, but actually if another thing happens, that is kind of normal, that's the normal variation of sleep. And for all of these challenges that come with not having enough sleep or the right type of sleep or, you know, restorative sleep, there will always be like different things that people can try. Because I think part one of the challenges possibly as well, going back to Kat's point, and then I'll come back to Tessa's point, is that it feels quite hopeless, doesn't it? Like everyone, I'm sure, listening to the podcast will have had times in their life where they just couldn't sleep for a few nights. And you get into this cycle where you think, like, this is it now. Like, this is going to be it for like the next 90 years. Like, I'm never, ever going to be able to get to sleep at like, and have 6 hours or 8 hours before I go to work. And that feels, I think, like quite, it just feels like quite real and quite vivid. And I think that also contributes to challenges. And whereas one person might let a friend know or someone else know, I think sometimes an autistic person might feel more shy to contact another person to tell them, like, this is really bleak now, you know, it's been like a week, you know, for example, in London at the moment, it's really been hot. So I think most people have had disrupted sleep this week, but I think some people may not feel confident or comfortable to let another person know, or to ask, like, what are you doing about it? Or just to say, this is a bit rubbish. And sometimes even that on its own is like a really important thing. But Tassos was asking about, like, the downsides of not having enough restorative sleep. I mean, things that come to my mind is it is just harder to function, I think, like, in the day, like, practically. Like, most of us have, like, a short window, especially if we're not morning people. It's not, like, 2 hours to get ready. Although I did once live with someone who allowed herself 2 hours in the morning. I'm more of a, like, you can get out the door in 20 minutes and you can drink coffee and you can probably eat breakfast and have a shower and do all these things. So I think those everyday things that we have to do, going to work, doing the effortful things at work, talking to people, answering emails, making decisions quite quickly, I think all of that just becomes, like, biologically, it's more difficult to do that because the body's just saying, I haven't got enough energy here. I haven't got enough kind of oomph to do these things. I think it can have, like, a negative impact on mood and anxiety. So if somebody already has some anxiety symptoms or doesn't feel great in themselves mood wise, I think when we're tired, it is much more difficult to think through all the options in a situation, decide which is the right option for me here. I think we're much more likely to jump to a conclusion or kind of go down the worst case scenario in a way, like, that our brain is kind of somehow wired to do that, isn't it? It's like using the information I have right now, like, what seems the best option, but we can't go through all those options sequentially when we're more anxious or more down. So I think it can reinforce anxiety, the sense of anxiety, and also low mood. I think the two other things I think are, one, I think it reduces people's, like, interest in doing things that they might ordinarily enjoy, because suddenly needing to get sleep, needing to get the right sleep, needing to get the right amount of sleep does just naturally become more of a priority. And so if someone says, oh, would you like to come for a drink or go for dinner or can I come round and watch a video? Actually, that, even if that would be ordinarily, like, a really nice thing to do, it's a bit like, well, if they come at 7, then they might not leave till 10 and I'll have a few things to do before I go to bed and then I won't be in bed till 11. And so I think it can almost indirectly, like, reduce down the options that people have to do things that they like doing. And actually, Tassos and I would always say we want people to do more of the things that they enjoy doing more of the time. And the last thing that I was going to say is just that I think it can contribute to, like, a sense of hopelessness and, like, feeling slightly defeated, that actually when we're really tired, if the day feels more effortful, we're feeling a bit more anxious, we're not feeling kind of that inclined to meet people and do, like, social things, whether that's, you know, kind of online or with people in person. I think that becomes a bit of a, like, reinforcing negative cycle of, like, it's never going to get better, it's always going to be like this. And all of us take thoughts like that to bed from time to time, but that having those kinds of thoughts most nights of the week, I think that will have a knock-on effect on poorer sleep, so less restorative sleep. And then I think it kind of all goes round in a loop where the less sleep we have, the more worried about it we are, the more effortful and fatigued we feel, the less sleep we have. That was a long answer to your question, sorry.
That was perfect. I think that will resonate with an awful lot of people listening. And I think it's really heartening, though, to sort of think of how it's not sort of that we're predestined to have terrible sleep at the same time. I think that's so important for people to remember if they're listening and they're in that sort of cycle or they're feeling quite challenged by their sleep. It's not something that we're sort of sentenced to at all. And are there some sort of strategies that people can maybe use to sort of help them with their sleep regulation?
Debbie is really excellent in kind of, you know, going through these the different kind of strategies and all of that. But the one thing I wanted to kind of emphasize. So one suggestion is, there is an excellent, actually, article or study, I think it's back from 2019, and it talks about the, speaking about the sensory processing profile and everything. So the article is about the sensory overreactivity and how that affects sleep. And in simple terms, that means that some people or some individuals, if you like, who are on the spectrum, may respond to specific textures and sounds and smells or temperature of the room in much more intense, if you like, manner comparing to others. And I guess it's, there are two layers of if you like, a struggle there. The first one is that when they try to explain, even if they try to kind of communicate that to others, if other people are not familiar or they're not kind of aware of it, they're more likely to dismiss it and say, well, I think you're overreacting. I think, you know, you can cope with that. And actually, they're not overreacting at all. Basically, it's directly linked to their sensory profile. And remembering that, I think it's really important, because then it takes away some of this kind of guilt people may feel. And as Debbie said, it can prevent them actually from sharing these issues they may have with others out of fear that they will be bullied or ridiculed or whatever. And someone can start with very simple things. So if you create a map of the things that provide comfort, I guess, and they help you to calm down and kind of relax and switch off. And these are things that vary significantly from one person to another. So it's a very individualized approach. It's a very individualized approach, even when it comes down to how much is enough. Not everyone needs 8 hours of sleep. Not everyone needs 6 hours of sleep. The problem is when you were sleeping, let's say, X amount of hours, and that was fine, and your performance was okay, and you didn't feel that you didn't have any difficulties and everything, and then suddenly something happens, and then things are not okay anymore. But that's not necessarily how someone else may feel. So it's very individualized. But things like, as I said, you know, to create a map, to try to, when I say a map, I don't literally mean a map, but I mean a list of things that I as a person, let's say I as Tassos, find really calming and relaxing. I will never forget when someone kept telling me, look, if you hear, I think it was sound of the rain or something like this, it will literally help you. It will help you immensely to switch off and go to sleep. Well, I can tell you, it didn't help at all. It was making me more actually agitated. And I kept thinking, well, if this person said it, who knows really well, they are right. But they were wrong, right? Because for me, it just didn't work. Something else did work. So that's what I mean when I say to kind of create a list of what works for you as a person, and then see how you can, I guess, integrate these kind of things to and implement strategies which will then be more tailored to to our profile, and I guess if they are more relevant to us, they're more likely to be effective. But this, and I'm happy to send you the link, I got this paper about the sensory overreactivity and the impact in the architecture of sleep, is a great example of how individualized and how tailored needs to be, meaning the support and the overall management, if we want to really kind of help others. There are things, we'll talk about diet as well, things about exercise, to avoid intense exercise just before going to bed. Debbie did mention the exposure to blue light, especially. But again, and I know Debbie probably will kind of tell me off because of that. It's very easy to say to someone, stop doing this, stop doing that, stop doing that, stop doing that. Well, and we forget that, well, people do not actually behave like this. There's no point coming up with a whole list of don'ts, because then it's less likely that the other person will engage with what you say, because they will think, well, you obviously don't understand where I'm coming from, because you're telling me every single thing I enjoy doing, let's say before going to sleep, you tell me don't do that. And so it's not do nothing or do all of that. I guess if you engage more and speak to them in a little bit more detail, you will find a kind of middle ground where things they already do, you may be able to modify and adapt so they have less of an impact in, let's say, someone's sleep, but you retain this sense of reward and pleasure. Plus, you help them to kind of develop the skills to be their own managers of their sleep in the long run.
I think also it is quite important to understand what people mean when they say they have like problems with their sleep. So I think even like a step back from any strategies is when someone describes or you notice that someone has sleep problems, just to find out what that means. So for them, because actually somebody might not think that spending 2 hours to get to sleep is an issue for them. They're not bothered by that. But what they are bothered about is when they wake up in the morning for college or for work, that they don't feel refreshed. Or it might be the other way around. People don't mind what time they wake up in the morning, but that initial bit of getting into bed and the mind kind of racing, that is just really uncomfortable. So I think finding out what people mean by problems with sleep is like important, because the more we kind of, when I say we, like the person, people around them, maybe health professionals, the more we understand about it, the broader the range of strategies. Because going back to your idea, you know, your thought, Kat, earlier about, well, am I just going to be, you know, is bad sleep just going to be destiny? It is, I think, really important for people to know that probably everybody in their lifetime will have periods where their sleep is much better and periods where their sleep is more vulnerable, because our sleep is one of the first things to get affected if we're having a more difficult time, a more busy time, a more fatiguing time. People kind of now might have COVID and then just be taking longer to kind of feel more kind of back to their usual selves, the sleep. They might need kind of more sleep than has been usual. But the more we understand about what the problems are and also people's expectations for their sleep, the more targeted interventions or strategies can be. So I think knowing what people mean by sleep problems is the first bit, and knowing what people would like their sleep to be like is important, because some people sometimes, I'm thinking of people who might have a period of depression. So typically they've been able to sleep 6 or 7 or 8 hours without any disruption. They're now having a difficult time and they're struggling to get to sleep, but also struggling to get up in the morning. It's like, where would that person like their sleep to go? Is it that they hope that next week they will be able to sleep 8 hours uninterrupted? Or is there a kind of more graded kind of approach to that? But I think another thing to think about in terms of strategies, that was part of the question, is strategies kind of have to be outside of the bedroom and bed as well as within that space. So they kind of start from the beginning of the day, really, that actually if someone's going to be able to get themselves into a better routine with their sleep as much as they can, it does involve trying to get up at the same time most days of the week. In fact, actually, I think the hardcore like sleep researchers would say same time every day of the week. It always feels a bit harsh to say that to kind of people I work with, like on a Saturday and a Sunday, you must get up at 7:15 because that's when you're getting up Monday to Friday. But the more that we can show our bodies that there is this rhythm to our day, the more beneficial that is for our sleep-wake cycle. But being able to get up at approximately the same time, staggering meal times through the day, I think sometimes people kind of stave off, they don't have breakfast and they wait a few hours, but already the body's going to struggle a bit more and we're going to have lulls, and then it's easier to go for a nap or lie down kind of towards the end of the day, and that disrupts the night. So thinking about what people do in the day and when they're like, when the activity is, some people really like to do stuff in the evening. Some people might find that over alerting or just a bit much. So actually doing the social things earlier on in the day might be helpful. I am really not a fan of blue light. I am one of those people that really, I don't say don't, because that seems harsh, but strongly suggest trying what it's like without blue light at night. But as Tassos says, if we can't tell people what they mustn't do, it's much more useful to think with people what works for you. So there are dimmest, I don't know what they're called, like the technical term, but there you can turn the vividity of the screen off, can't you? You can turn the brightness down on a mobile phone or a tablet. So all of those kinds of things are helpful, as well as maybe identifying like what's an activity that I could do after the blue light is gone off, but before I go to bed. So something that's engaging, but not giving my brain the sense that I need to be awake, I need to be alert. I was thinking that if an autistic person is living with other people in a shared space, and I know some people will be able to have open conversations with their like housemates or family, and some people that might be difficult. But actually, if somebody's really sensitive to noise and it is driving them bananas when the washing machine goes on at like 11:15 at night, having a conversation with people about why that's like really not an optimal time for them might be helpful. Sometimes it's about swapping bedrooms. Like a person might have the bedroom next to the bathroom, but actually every time someone goes for a shower or to the toilet, it's kind of wakes them up. So is there like, could they do swapsies with someone else just so that they're in a room that's maybe a bit quieter? And I guess, I'm going to go back to this idea of like kindness, like being kind to oneself. But I think also there is a whole range of strategies that we can test, and I can send resources rather than just listing them. But I think if one thing doesn't work now, that's okay, because there will be other things to try. But I also think if something doesn't work, like for me this evening, I shouldn't discount that as like, that's never going to work for me ever again, because it might work for me at a different point in my life. So there are lots of things that we can do that can be small changes. I guess that's the last thing that I will say, is changing lots of things all at the same time is really difficult for any of us, but it's also too big an ask, I think, for a person. Mm-hmm. So having a list of what might be some of the things that I could kind of tweak just to see, does it make a difference, and try that out for 3 or 4 or 5 nights and then move on to something else or add something else in, I think gives people a better chance now to have a better sleep cycle, but also for the future, then they've got a much better idea about, well, there's just no point trying X because that definitely didn't work for me, but some of these other things seemed to work, so they might be more inclined to try those again.
Oh, and I love that idea of sort of extending kindness to yourself, and from the start of the day thinking about how you can be kind to yourself in a way that will impact you later on. It's lovely, it's really nice. And then you sort of talked about the things that people around the autistic person can do, so in terms of sort of understanding their specific sensory sensitivities. And I know I, as a child, was always referred to as the princess and the pea, because anything would upset my sleep, any sort of sensory difference. Are there other things that potentially family members could do to support sleep?
I mean, I don't know if a lot of families with autistic people and families with people without, who are not autistic, do a lot of people talk about sleep? Like, I kind of think like maybe just starting to talk about it. Like, we make assumptions, all of us make assumptions about what another person's experiences in their life are like, but we don't necessarily talk about these things that are quite kind of implicit. So I wonder if having a conversation just to find out about what different people in the family find really unhelpful, what they find useful, there's something I think validating about that, but also kind of normalizing. So a family might be going through a difficult time together, maybe if they're somebody has passed away and everyone in the family is bereaved and trying to kind of cope with that and cope with everyday life. People might learn different things that are useful to them. I also think I'm going to go back to this idea of kindness, but if somebody's not sleeping well, they're probably not going to be like feeling like 100% on top form the next day. And so I'm not suggesting that a parent or a teacher or someone should massively change their expectations of a person, but I think the expectations of the person should be proportionate to how that person is feeling. So if someone's going through a period where they're not sleeping more than a couple of hours a night, they are going to be a bit more grumpy, a bit more tired. So asking them to do something that's really challenging for them, like going to a social thing that they like, a Christmas, that's a good example. School's ended, normal routine is like changed. There's this build up to doing this like whole big Christmas thing with lots of people that the person doesn't want to do. Like, one has to kind of manage one's expectations about what's fair and proportionate if that person is running on like half a tank of sleep rather than like completely topped up. So I think that's useful, but I also think it is helpful to work together to think about like what's going to be helpful for this person. So if they need more downtime of an evening, like not carting them around, like this is a bit of an extreme example, but going shopping like at 8 o'clock in the night or something like that, or having people around for a late evening meal when you know that person needs a bit of time to decompress before they go to bed. So I think small things like that can be helpful.
Just to add, while Debbie was talking about expectations and everything, I wanted to say, and of course, you know, if someone's, let's say, performance or the way they respond to either in a family setting or at school and everything changes at some point, because we do talk about how the environment can actually support the individual, I think it is really, really helpful for people to be aware that sometimes this kind of change, as Debbie said, may be because of, you know, sleep problems. And again, going back to the misconceptions and misunderstandings, to have this kind of link or association in our minds that, wait a second, maybe he's or she or they are grumpy today. Maybe it's because they don't sleep very well, or, and for whatever reason, we haven't had the chance to talk about it. Then a supporting environment or accommodating environment is an environment that, as Debbie said, it's not to provide excuses for everything, but it is an environment that kind of takes into consideration all the different reasons why someone may not perform or may not behave as you would expect. And I think it's really important, both for parents or teachers and everything, to remember that. It's not, you know, the sleep is in a different planet and then the autistic spectrum or the individual lives in another planet. It's not like that. They're so interconnected.
Thanks so much to Debbie and Tassos for chatting with me and sharing their expertise. Remember, the podcast is not a substitute for medical advice. So if you're having any difficulties with any of the issues discussed, please reach out directly to a qualified professional. I hope we all get a good night's sleep. Mind yourself. Thanks for listening.